this week on the Back Table Podcast.
So just like you, I really didn't get much training on menopause in my residency. I think we had like one lecture a year, and it was kind of just, I was a reproductive endocrinologist at the time who was like, well, as my patients got older and I got older, we were all going through menopause, and she kind of picked things up and told us along the way, but we really didn't see a lot of patients on it. We really didn't do a lot. And so just like you, as I got into practice, I had to learn a lot more about that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table OBGYN podcast, your source for all things obstetrics and gynecology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on backtable.com. Welcome back to another episode of Back Table OBGYN. This is your host, Mark Hoffman, and we have another great guest today and a friend of mine, Dr. Jessica Rich. Dr. Rich, how are you?
I'm doing great. So excited to be here today.
I'm glad to have you, a fellow podcaster, and we'll get into that in just a second. Jessica and I have known each other for a long time. She is a minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon at the Florida Center for Urogynecology and host of the Enriched Menopause podcast. So I was trying to think back when we met, and I remembered it was in when I was a resident, right? And you were a med student at University of Chicago, and we could just keep kind of like bumping into each other over the years.
It was. I was just thinking back to then as well, because obviously with being both minimally invasive gynecologists, we bump into each other a lot. But I was like, oh, actually, it was when I was a medical student and you were my
resident.
You
were on your sub-I or something like that, maybe.
Yes.
And we're good. It's always good to see you. Always good to catch up. And thank you for joining us on today's episode to talk about your podcast and also about menopause. This is something that I think you've talked about in your podcast, but also, you know, we don't get a lot of menopause education in residency, at least I didn't, because a lot of our resident clinics are OB heavy or and a lot of younger patients. So that was something that when I got out of residency and into practice, especially as a gynecologist, I was getting a lot more exposure into menopause than I ever thought I would. So tell us about your practice. Tell us about, you know, where you are and how you got there, and then we'll get into menopause.
Great. So as you mentioned, I'm at the Florida Center for Urogynecology. It's a private practice. I'm the minimally invasive gynecologist in the practice, and we have now two urogynecologists. We don't do any obstetrics. We don't do any cancer sort of stuff. We really focus on benign gynecology. We have some great pelvic floor physical therapists in our practice. We have like a really great center for that sort of thing, which means that we do specialize a lot in the things that we see as minimally invasive in urogynecologists, like fibroids and bleeding and pelvic pain and endometriosis and prolapse and incontinence and all of those things. But we also do a lot of just routine gynecology. So running the gamut from, you know, adolescence all the way up to 102. So just like you, I really didn't get much training on menopause in my residency. I think we had like one lecture a year, and it was kind of just, I was a reproductive endocrinologist at the time who was like, well, as my patients got older and I got older, we were all going through menopause, and she kind of picked things up and told us along the way, but we really didn't see a lot of patients on it. We really didn't do a lot. And so just like you, as I got into practice, I had to learn a lot more about that.
We were so lucky in my practice when I first started. Kathy Dillon was, so like our division of, what do we call ourselves? Gynecologic specialties, I think, because I was the first MIG surgeon, and then we had a urogyn, and then we had Kathy Dillon, who was doing GYN only menopause in clinic. And so we became this little like land of misfit toys. But I mean, she was NAMS certified, North American Menopause Society, which I'd never heard of until I met Kathy. But she had become like the resource. I mean, it was unbelievable how much she knew. And so, yeah, I definitely have had that experience of just understanding not just what we didn't know, but how much is out there and how much one person can know. So I'm sure your patients are very lucky that you've taken an interest in menopause, that you have decided to make that a big part of your practice. But so what have you done to sort of become, I assume like all the menopause patients get referred to you now, that you're someone who has an interest and expertise in menopause?
Well, definitely when I started out in practice, it was really that you know, as a urogynecology practice, we see so many women who have genitourinary syndrome of menopause. So basically, almost everybody who walks through our doors gets some vaginal estrogen or some counseling, therefore. But then they were having all of these other issues, too. And I was doing a lot of the routine care visits and hearing a lot about menopause. And so it was really something that my patients brought to me first. It wasn't something that I went and sought out initially. But just like anything else I do in my practice, I always want to find answers for people. So if it's something that I'm not sure about, I'm going to go and do a deep dive and do the research and talk to as many people as I can and listen and read up on what I can do and really try to get solutions for my patients. So that's really how it started. And then as I progressed and as I'm getting a little older now as well and in perimenopause myself, I really started to see more and more patients and see more and more symptoms and really just hear about people who were just being ignored or just getting kind of the standard brush off from the routine OBGYNs that they were seeing. Not because there's anything wrong with those OBGYNs, but, you know, they're very busy with delivering babies and these other things, and they didn't get this stuff in their training either. So I just sort of took it upon myself to learn more about it and to kind of grow with what my patients' needs were.
Now, I will put myself into that group of people who just, you know, I didn't know a lot, and for what I was doing, it wasn't sort of what I trained to do. And yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna pretend like I was nearly as dedicated and thoughtful as you in my approach to dealing with menopause. And I was a little spoiled with Kathy Dillon, and now Kate Harris, who is our who's on our team, a nurse practitioner, who has sort of learned from Kathy and become like my go-to. So now I have this another person now who has like sort of taken that on. But all these questions start, and I just like, I don't know. It's kind of, I feel like it's like someone asking me an obstetrics question these days. I'm like, you should probably ask an obstetrician. Yeah. So I've been a little spoiled because I have people in my practice who are like you, interested, dedicated, educated, and understand the complexity of it. So how much of your practice now is menopause or management of perimenopause symptoms in that population? Because I imagine you're also a busy surgeon.
Right. So I still do a lot of, you know, fibroids and bleeding and endometriosis and pelvic pain. But honestly, a lot of it starts to go hand in hand a little bit. So particularly when the people are coming to me with bleeding issues, you know, sometimes it may be partly related to their fibroids, but it may also be perimenopause or hormonal issues. So there's a lot of overlap. I would say, you know, definitely the menopause side of things is growing, especially since I've been doing the podcast and I have my patients who refer their friends to the podcast and then their friends come and see me and their family members. And so it's growing more and more, but there really honestly is a lot of overlap between the patients that I'm seeing too. So I may take somebody to the OR to treat their fibroids and then we still have to deal with their perimenopause issues afterwards. So it's quite a bit.
And if I'm being honest with myself, we're gynecologists, so we take care of a lot of postmenopausal bleeding, or like you said, patients who have perimenopausal bleeding, how are we managing that? And we address the bleeding, and now it's like, oh, well, now you go talk to somebody about, you know, your hot flashes, because I don't know anything about it. But the reality is that's, you know, taking care of the whole patient, and that's what we should be working. I'm much better than I used to be and much more educated than I used to be. But I thought my lack of appropriate education on menopause is a great reason to have you on the show and tell us all about it. So let's talk about your show a little bit, and then we'll get into sort of some more medical stuff too. But where did that come from?
Right. So, and as you mentioned, like, I think it's great when you're in a big academic institution and you can kind of segment those things out a little bit. And I always thought that that's how I would practice, and that's just not really how life turned out. So when you're in private practice, you kind of have to, I mean, not that you can't refer things out, but you kind of want to take care of people, their whole issues a little bit more when you don't have quite the same amount of partners to put people through or put to in your same institution. But the show really originated, you know, rewind back to early 2020. I was very pregnant with my third baby, and I had her about a week before everything closed down with the pandemic. And I was feeling very burnt out and overwhelmed with being a busy surgeon, with having my third baby, with everybody suddenly being at home. with the pandemic, and I was really looking, you know, like, what else am I going to do with this stage of my career? So I got into a bit of a physician coaching group, and there was a lot about, you know, kind of putting yourself out there, that we have things to share with people in general, and that it doesn't have to be some perfect message each time, but to get out there on social media and in other pathways. So I started to experiment a little bit with, you know, Instagram and TikTok and YouTube and all of these other things. And while I was doing that, I started to think, okay, well, you know, maybe a podcast would be a good way to go. And I had a TikTok video that I had done. It was just like 1 minute something on genitourinary syndrome of menopause. Didn't think much of it. I think I did it like, I don't know, in some side office one day just after I saw a patient and I wanted to talk to people about it. And it went, for me, what was viral, not really viral in the like millions of views kind of ways, but, you know, within, you know, a weekend, it was over 100,000 people that,
oh, wow,
that took a look at it.
That's viral for anybody, I think.
So I thought, you know, there's really something here. There's really a place where people are lacking information. And of course, I knew that we lacked that information in our training. I knew that my patients were coming to me just feeling lost and needing answers. And at the time, there really wasn't a lot of stuff out there. So I kind of just started to jot down some ideas. And just off the top of my head, I had like 25 episodes on menopause, and I knew people that I wanted to bring in and talk about it. So I just said, well, let me just get started, and I'll learn this as I go, and I'll bring the information that I have, and I'll bring on experts to bring the information that I don't have. And it's really been a great experience.
So is it just you? I mean, are you recording, editing, promoting? Like, is this 100% you?
It's not 100% me, but mostly. So all of the ideas, all the scheduling comes from me. I do have a virtual assistant who, you know, posts it and does some social media stuff. And I do have a podcast editor, because at first, the first, I'd say 10 episodes, I edited myself. And then that was just not sustainable, because it took a lot of time. And I'm a mom of three, a busy surgeon. I was trying to do these episodes weekly, which is what I've been doing. And so I do have an editor, and I do have a social media person, but mostly it's me.
No, I mean, look, we do this show every couple of weeks. We have a full team behind us that we did not build. We were lucky to get to be a part of it. And we've got, you know, you met our engineer Aaron when we started before the show started. So you see how much help I've gotten to be able to do this at all. So to think about what you've done on your own is it's not a small amount of work. So it's very impressive. The show's great, by the way. And if you haven't listened to it, we'll put that in the show notes too. But Enrich Menopause, wherever you get your podcast. But good for you. Congrats. It's fantastic. And I was so excited to see it just like popped up, I think, on my social media. I was like, oh, wow. Amazing. We got to get her on. So good for you. That's awesome.
Thank you. And I found it to be like really a valuable resource in general, just for, of course, I send it to friends and family members and things. But with my patients, you know, we only have so much time in the office when we're counseling somebody. And menopause is one of those things that it's so broad, and it takes a lot of time, and people need a lot of counseling. So it's a really easy tool for me to say, okay, I'm going to start you on this, and this is what I think's going on, and listen to like this episode, and this episode, and then we'll like come back and refresh. So it actually really helps my practice a lot, and saves me some time.
That's how you're getting your listeners. You're making your patients go run your numbers up. No, that's brilliant though. It's a great clinical tool. I mean, it's a great way to communicate with your patients, like you said, in a way that is outside of the scope of what you have the time for in a 15-minute visit or whatever, you know, whatever we're allowed the time we're allotted to see a patient. And so to be able to actually talk to them through your podcast, and then they can write their questions down, come back, and you can probably save a ton of time, and they feel like they're getting a lot more information. That's fantastic.
They are. I mean, there's only so much you can cover, and even like a 30-minute visit, right? There's only so much you can cover. I've got hours of podcasts out there that they can listen to. So it's great. And I've also had the opportunity of learning from so many of the experts that I've had come on. So menopause affects people from head to toe. So I've had dermatologists and cardiologists and neuroscientists and nutritionists and personal trainers and kind of the whole gamut of people come on, and I learn a lot from them, and then I can incorporate that into my practice too. So it's been really wonderful.
You know, and your podcast is patient facing, right?
Yes.
That's the audience versus our show, which is physician facing. So we know you know how to communicate with patients, and you've done a great job with that. But for our listeners who are primarily physicians and APPs and other women's healthcare providers, talk to us about sort of your side of things. Like what are the most common complaints that you're getting? What are the things that you manage the most frequently in your clinic in terms of menopause, perimenopause complaints?
So most of the time it's those patients that, you know, I used to just kind of give a big sigh when I saw the chief complaint coming, that it's like hormonal imbalance or they just don't feel right, you know? So a lot of people are coming in, they just don't feel like themselves. They know that something's off. They may have the more recognizable symptoms like hot flushes and things. And those people are a little bit easier to pinpoint. They may have more of the irregular periods, and that's a little bit more easier to pinpoint too. But so many times it's just the like, I don't feel like myself. I'm fatigued. I'm not interested in my partner anymore. I have more mood swings. I maybe have pains in different parts of my body that I wasn't as, you know, used to having, like in the joints, or I'm getting headaches, or, you know, whatever it might be. It's usually like a whole constellation of symptoms. But I would say the most common thing that people are telling me is that, like, I just don't feel right. I just don't feel like myself. I feel like my body's turning on me, or I just don't recognize myself in my own body. And so just like when we have to go through and really tease out what's exactly going on with somebody who's got, you know, chronic pelvic pain or abnormal bleeding, it's the same sort of thing. We have to kind of tease out, okay, well, what do you mean by that? And what is that symptom? And how frequently is it happening? And can you track it with your cycles? And it just takes that sort of careful dissection of the history to get to the bottom of things.
I mean, we all hear that all the time. We all hear, I just don't feel like myself. But to then take that and try to, you know, tease out actual things. I mean, the amount of patience that you have. I imagine your kids are very, you know, I think of your kids as being very lucky. My kids have a father who's not nearly as patient.
I'm learning patience.
So when patients say, you know, I don't feel like myself, like what's an example of like, you know, how you might address that, the kind of things you might find in a patient who says, I just don't feel like myself? Because it's such a fake complaint, right? It's so hard to sort of know where that can lead.
Right. So just like, you know, we're taught in medical school, you kind of start with the broad questions and try to narrow it in. So, you know, what do you mean by that? And then we kind of get into, okay, is it the fatigue? And are you feeling that all the time? Are you feeling that at certain parts of your cycle? You know, when we're talking about, you know, low libido or not being interested in your partner, I mean, some of that is maybe you just don't like a partner, but some of that is, you know, hormonal changes and genitourinary syndrome of menopause and pain with sex. And so it's really that I'm getting into like asking each of those questions. And honestly, when you start diving into it, you'll realize that it really does affect every part of their body. So they may be having headaches. They may be having joint pains. They're having, you know, more depression, more anxiety. They're having hot flushes. They're having weight gain. That's one that I hear a lot. Everybody's worried about the weight gain around the abdomen, which is, you know, that more kind of central obesity we always hear about. That becomes an issue a lot. I have so many women that come to me and they say, you know, like I just turned 40 or I just turned 45 or I just turned 50 and I'm doing all of the same things and I'm gaining all of this weight and I just don't feel like getting out of bed anymore. So those are the types of things that we hear a lot. And so a lot of it is just reassurance in the first part of things, you know, just telling people, okay, you're not going crazy. Your body's not, you know, abandoning you, but that this is a change and this is a change that's as big as puberty. And once I can start to, you know, have people assess it in that way, they're like, oh yeah, like my body changed pretty drastically and permanently in puberty. And everybody sort of expected that change and they knew that they were going to go through it. But for some reason, I think because menopause and luckily we're talking about menopause a lot more now in these last, you know, year or two. But, you know, menopause for such a long time has been something that hasn't been talked about, has been completely ignored. So many people are shocked when they get there. And no matter what the age of the patient, I always hear them saying, oh, but I'm too young for this. I can't be going through this. And really, those perimenopausal changes can start as early as the mid-30s, even in normal menopause, let alone, you know, like premature ovarian insufficiency and things like that. So, you know, you really just have to have an ear for it and think about, you know, what could be going on. Lab tests can be helpful, but they're not that great. And so it's really like listening to the complaints and trying to work people through that.
Can we talk about labs for a second? Because, I mean, I have so many people coming in of all ages. I want my hormones checked. I want my hormones checked. I want my hormones checked, which, you know, there's a lot of different types of practices out there. And we have patients that see homeopathic or naturopaths, or and there's other names that they use. But, you know, people who are getting their hormones checked on a regular basis and they're getting the pellets and the hormonal implants and those things. Can we talk a little bit about hormones? Because I think I have a very sort of old school understanding of like vaginal dryness, vaginal estrogen, hot flashes, systemic estrogen. Otherwise, I got nothing. You know, I can stay away from those hormone salesmen, snake oil salesmen who are just trying to get rich off normal things. So am I close? Am I way off in my management? Like help me out here, because I sort of feel like I'm doing what I was taught years ago, but is that as much evolved? Tell me how you approach those types of questions, those types of patients.
Yeah, you're actually not that far off. So I do give yourself a little pat on the back. The same thing. So many people come in, I want to check my hormones. And so at the same time, I don't just say, okay, let's check your hormones. I say, okay, well, what is it that's bothering you? Why do you want to check your hormones? And let's talk about whether this is going to be useful or not. And most of the time I'm telling them, I don't think this is going to be very useful, but we can check. Now, sometimes it is, right? If they're having irregular periods and symptoms, we want to look for things like PCOS. We want to rule out, you know, thyroid disease. We want to look for, you know, prolactin issues. So all of these other things. But honestly, you know, I'll check an FSH because if it's elevated, it kind of confirms what I tell patients we already know, that you're at least in perimenopause. The level is not going to tell me when you're postmenopausal. So if you don't have a uterus, that's a little trickier to do. But, you know, we have to go by the periods at least somewhat. But we'll check an FSH and we'll look at things like estradiol and progesterone and testosterone. I don't even require a baseline for that. I do it if somebody wants to know it, but I'm not going to treat somebody based on those numbers. I would use those numbers more, you know, when we're treating somebody, if we want to adjust the dosing or if we want to sort of look and see if things are getting, you know, a little too high around those areas, then I would look at those hormones. But most of the time, the labs are fairly useless to me other than ruling out the other conditions that can kind of mimic perimenopause and menopause, particularly the thyroid disease. And the way that I always counsel my patients is I tell them, look, we're not going to treat a number. And while there are, especially here in South Florida, so many of these bioidentical hormone clinics that say, you know, we're going to test your saliva or your blood or your urine, and we're going to look at these levels of hormones, and we're going to give you this number of hormones based on, you know, what it is. And I have so many patients that come to me and they say, well, I'm on this because my level was low. And I was like, okay, but what were you feeling to get on this? I don't want to treat a number. I don't want to treat a lab. What number you have today is going to be different than the number you have tomorrow versus next week, because they're still fluctuating. And what number feels good to me is going to be different than what number feels good to my patient and to their sister and to their neighbor. So we really want to treat based on symptoms, not based on those lab numbers.
Okay, good. I feel a little bit better that I, you know, because I mean, that's what I tell folks, like, I care about you and how you feel, not the labs. If the labs say you're not in menopause, but you're having hot flashes and vaginal dryness, like, do we treat? I mean, do we ignore those symptoms? I don't want to ignore the symptoms if patients are saying they're having those symptoms. So,
and you're in line with ACOG and the North American Menopause Society, so don't worry. You're on the right track.
Good, good, good. So the other big thing I want to ask, though, about this in terms of hormones is testosterone. A lot of testosterone questions, and I feel like I don't know anything helpful to tell patients about testosterone. I know that ovaries do produce testosterone, and I understand that when you go into menopause, your ovarian hormone production goes down. That includes testosterone. Is that, you're nodding, so I'm hoping that I'm somewhat right here. What, tell me what you know about testosterone in the menopausal patient and what we can be telling our patients.
That is true. So definitely the ovaries are producing testosterone. The testosterone seems to drop off a little bit later than the estrogen does. So we tend to lose estrogen a little bit sooner and progesterone, and the testosterone kind of drops off a little bit later. I will tell you that my opinion on testosterone has been evolving, and it's still evolving. But here's what we know. We do know that women who are getting testosterone supplementation do feel better in terms of less fatigue, more energy. They have improvements in libido and in muscle mass. So it can be helpful in those ways. We do know there can be side effects to testosterone. So abnormal hair growth, acne, this sort of virilization, things like voice deepening, clitoral megaly, things like that, that people don't necessarily want. We don't know a whole lot about risks. These are not really well studied in women. So the studies that we do have typically are, followed for 6 months or less. They're usually using like a topical patch that's not available in the United States. And, it looks like, at least from those small studies, that things are fairly safe in women. And when we look at men, of course, the concerns in men are always things like cancers, prostate and testicular cancers, and cardiovascular disease. Some of the newer evidence suggests that it may be safer in men than we had originally thought. But there's really still not a lot of data on women. So it's not something that I start with. The argument I think a lot of people make who do a lot of testosterone therapy is that, we would offer this to men. We care more about, men's quality of life, it seems, than we care about women's. And I agree, there's a lot of things that we do for men that we don't necessarily do for women. But I do think it's more of a conversation. I do think it shouldn't be your testosterone's low and you need testosterone. It should be a conversation about the risks and benefits. And just because somebody's male partner will take anything at any risk to improve their sex life does not necessarily mean that the woman wants to do the same. And so it's really a conversation about risks and benefits. When I'm starting someone on a hormone replacement therapy, I always start with estrogen and then, of course, progesterone if they have a uterus to protect the uterus. And then even if they've come to me for testosterone, I say, well, let's just wait on that. Let's see how you feel first with the estrogen, because a lot of the symptoms that they're having in terms of the fatigue and also the libido and energy, those are going to improve with the estrogen alone, which are much better studied. We know the risks and benefits in women of estrogen and progesterone much better than we know testosterone. And then I say, if you're still having very bothersome symptoms, then we're going to consider adding a topical testosterone. But that can get a little bit trickier.
Is it trial and error, really? I mean, are you measuring testosterone? I know we talked about labs a minute ago, but do you check testosterone levels in women at all? Is there any value in that?
I do check them initially, but again, the initial is really more to rule out the other things, particularly in the perimenopausal person, to see if it's a PCOS issue or something along those lines. If I'm supplementing testosterone, which again, I don't start with, so it's not the majority of my patients who are on testosterone, but if I'm supplementing testosterone, then I will check the levels mostly to make sure that they're not getting like crazy high. There's no like set therapeutic levels for what a woman's testosterone should be. So it's not like you're titrating a dose to a specific level. It's more like, okay, well, what's the normal range of what a woman should have? And I do have some patients who are on the pellets and other things, not that I've given them the pellets because I do not do that, but who have come in on pellets and sometimes their levels are like 3-4 times what a normal, female should have in terms of a testosterone level. And I don't think that's where anybody needs to be.
What are the kinds of things we should be looking for? So you mentioned energy and libido. Are in terms of like response and dosing and things like that, I mean, we don't need to go through specific doses, but is it similar to estrogen where it's like, let's give you a little more, see how you feel, let's give you a little more, see how you feel, and then you sort of have a point where like, okay, I don't think any more is going to help, and it's more of a trial and error type thing?
A little bit. I mean, there are some guidelines. So there are basically a couple of different ways that you can do testosterone. Some people will do injections in the pellets. Like I said, I don't do that. The pellets, I'm not really that comfortable with. I think they're, poorly regulated, not well studied, can be inconsistent. There is, of course, FDA-approved testosterone for men, so a topical, a gel product that you can use. And generally for women, we just start at like a tenth of the dose of men. So not super scientific. It's like a pea-sized amount that they rub into their skin. So that's one way to do it. They probably won't have that covered by their insurance, but because the tube is going to last them so much longer than it would for a man, it's usually they, you know, one or two tubes in a year. The other way is to use a compounding pharmacy, which, you know, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of compounded bioidentical hormones. I do use compounding pharmacies when I need to, when I can't get something that's commercially available. And I have a few in my area that I feel comfortable with, but it's sort of the same thing. We just start at a low dose and then we kind of build up from there. And I will talk with the pharmacist specifically about how they make that and how we can dose each patient. But really, then I'm checking the levels to see, okay, are we getting too high? And then for the effectiveness to see, you know, basically it's always, how do you feel? How do you feel with that? And some people feel great with it. I would say the majority like feel great. They have more energy. They have, you know, their sex lives back. But I do have a lot of people too that's just like, whoa, that was too much. I don't want to be on that anymore. So it's always trial and error. You have to see how each person is going to respond to it, just like with anything else.
Do the ovaries still make a physiologic amount of testosterone that's a value after menopause? I mean, I know that there was this whole push, I think, like when we were in training, I'm a little bit older than you, but it was, if you get a hysterectomy, leave the ovaries out. And the last 10 or 15 years or so have been like, leave them in no matter what, unless there's something wrong with them. And now there's kind of the pendulum has swung back saying like, probably can take them out at 50 or if you take them out earlier, you can probably just give them HRT and they're fine. Like, What do we know about postmenopausal ovaries, what they do, whether it's estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, like, and how are you counseling patients on that?
Yeah, so generally the first thing that drops off is the progesterone, and that's typically because you're not really ovulating regularly anymore. So if you're not having that sort of ovulation trigger, you're not getting that same like rise in progesterone that you usually get after ovulation. So that tends to drop off first. And I think that's why I have so many patients that come in to see me who are just on progesterone because they've gotten some labs that show that they're low. And I don't see much value in that. I mean, progesterone, some evidence that it can help with sleep for people with sleep apnea. But in general, like nobody should just be on progesterone. Then, of course, the estrogen starts to drop off as the ovaries aren't responding more to the FSH. Even though FSH is going up and up, the ovaries are going to stop responding at some point. So the estrogen's going to drop off as well. And then testosterone's like a little bit of a lag. It's like a couple of years behind the estrogen and progesterone in terms of the drop off because it's not really that same, you know, cyclic stimulation that we see in the ovaries for the menstrual cycle. So the ovaries are still producing some testosterone even when the estrogen and progesterone are dropping. And then, of course, we have steroid hormone production in the adrenal glands, although much less so than we were getting from the ovaries. So it is a little bit of a slow drop. The majority of symptoms that we're seeing in perimenopause and menopause are due to, first of all, the erratic fluctuations of estrogen that are happening in perimenopause. And I will have some of those patients that come to me that are monitoring their labs all the time. I have a nurse who I see and she's always like, but the estrogen was so high. And then we kind of go through the pattern. We're like, yes, it went high because the FSH was so high and then it stimulated the estrogen. We're not going to treat the numbers. We're going to treat how people feel, kind of stabilize things along the way, and then see what we need to add back in to get you feeling better.
It does feel like we just don't know as much as we should. We've practiced in the field of women's healthcare for our whole careers now, and neither of us are shocked to, you know, talk about a problem that is specific to our female patients that is poorly understood or underfunded or those kinds of things. And so it does take people like you to take that extra step of listening to patients and seeing what works, seeing what's out there. Because, you know, I'm maybe a little more conservative in my practice for things I don't know about, which I don't think of as a bad thing. If I don't know about it, I'm not going to mess with it. But we are in many ways depriving our patients from options for treatment for things. If we just say, oh, well, you know, ACOG or NAMM says don't do it, that's that. Well, no, we just may not know enough. And so providing patients with the available information and say, look, this is what we know. This is what we don't know. These are the risks. Make sure we allow our patients to make as informed decisions as we can. But to say no without at least engaging that conversation does feel very paternalistic. So I think it's, I applaud you for your work and giving our patients that. And I think a lot of folks out there who are managing, who have practices and manage patients that have, you know, I guess docs who have a large menopausal volume in their practice that do this kind of stuff. I mean, there's clearly a need for it, but it's a huge part of the practice. And I hear a lot about it. In my practice, I just don't know much about it.
Yeah, of course, the funding for women's health is abysmal, and we don't know so much about so many things. And we're very quick to drop something if we start to see an issue, which I get. I think that the safety part is most important, but we definitely treat women differently than we treat men. And we need more information. But in the meantime, we have to kind of work with patients. And NAMS has sort of started to come around on the testosterone issue and does say that it's appropriate in certain areas. And like I said, that's taken me coming around too. At first, I was not very convinced about testosterone, but patients kept coming to me and asking for it. So, you know, I've talked to more people, done more research. And again, it's not like I'm going to give everybody testosterone, but I can say, okay, well, these are the risks that we know of. This is what we don't know. These are the benefits. And you know, then we make a decision together.
I've done the same thing with surgery. I think initially it was like, well, here's what we can do. I can't do this. And then it's like, well, and then, I'm not saying we should just say, well, whatever the patient wants, I'll do. Obviously, we have to be thoughtful and how I counsel. But I also trust patients to make informed decisions about themselves, right? We have cosmetic surgeons who do all sorts of things for no clinical reason, right? So I also think patients have bodily autonomy and they have the right to make decisions about themselves, even if it's not what I think I would do. And as a male gynecologist, I have no idea what I would do in that situation because many of the times I've never been in that situation. So number one, listen to your patients. It's like shockingly and not shockingly the most important thing we can do that we also just have to remind people to do again and again and again, and have patients say, you know, just thanks for listening, right? Like that's when the further along I've gotten, the better listener I hope I've gotten. But a lot of times we don't necessarily intervene or do anything, but just by listening, we can make a big impact for our patients. So huge part there. But I think educating ourselves enough, but allowing our patients to make informed decisions, saying, look, this is what, you know, this is what we don't know. So I think that's something I've done with surgery more and more is, you know, I don't know that I think that's what I would recommend, but I also, there's a possibility of improvement. And there's some value there. Like, you know, you understand the risks, you understand what we're getting into, and we document it, and we write it down, and we have a plan. And we, again, multiple visits, we're reviewing, you go home, read about it, but trust your patients, listen to your patients, trust your patients. It's like,
right. With anything else, you would just say, okay, well, this is what I would recommend, but you know, if this is something else you want to do, I think that's a reasonable decision. And these are the risks and benefits. So yes, we always have to listen to them and know we are not just, you know, technicians doing whatever people order up. But you know, we still have to listen to their needs and try to address them as well as we can.
And admit that we just don't know enough. We just don't know enough. And so, yeah, this is big black box of information out there that we doctors don't know. My wife's not in medicine. She's always asking, like, how could you guys not know this stuff? I'm like, somebody has to, you know, pay for someone's job to go do the research, to go figure these things out. And there's a lot out there to figure out. And so, you know, we don't know all the answers. And it is frustrating, I think, especially for patients, but especially for something like menopause, which is like, I understand some super rare thing. But this is basically everybody, right?
Yep, exactly.
Like half of everybody, I'd say. But unfortunately, the half that gets less funding, that has less support in healthcare. So it's not shocking, but it is something that like is not rare to go into menopause, right? It's basically like 100% of people eventually.
As long as you live long enough, it's going to
happen. That's right. So let's talk about sex. How much of your practice for menopause is around sexual function and changes in sexual function, whether it's hormonal, whether it's anatomic, physiologic, and those kinds of things?
Yeah, I see a whole lot of people for sexual function, and that's partly because of my menopause practice, but also partly because of my pelvic pain practice. So some of the people that I'm seeing, you know, are 19 with sexual function issues, but definitely you know, I'm seeing a lot more people who are coming in that kind of perimenopause, menopause with pain with sex, with lack of interest in sex, with dryness, discomfort, tearing, you know, genitourinary syndrome of menopause, lichen sclerosis, pelvic floor dysfunction, kind of all of the above. So we have to kind of capture all of those issues. And I never want to do too many things for somebody at once, but generally it's like multiple different issues that we're working on. So we're going to, you know, give them something for the lack of estrogen in the vagina. We're going to work on their pelvic floor if they have that issue. We're going to treat the lichen sclerosis if they have that issue. Generally, I'll start with those things first before I start doing things to treat libido overall, because if somebody's having pain with sex, of course they don't want to have sex. So that's like a given. So we'll work on those issues. And then if we're still having an issue, then I start to address the libido side of things a little bit more.
Is testosterone it for libido? What are our options? Because like you said, I think if it's pain in general, we have some options, like you said, whether it's just vaginal dryness and atrophy, like in sclerosis, which is, you know, you can see and treat, or musculoskeletal causes of pelvic pain and dyspareunia. But if they're not having those things and it's truly just libido, what are options? Because I do feel like I'm just letting people down every day when they say my libido's gone down. And I'm like, sorry. I would love to give them more information.
Yeah, so there are options out there. And again, it is one of those sort of multifaceted approaches. And there are a lot of changes that are happening in life at that time, too. So we have to kind of deal with all of that. Like I said, sometimes it's like you don't like your partner. Sometimes it's like you're running around between your job and your kids and your elderly parents that you're caring for and your PTA meetings. And you just like sex is the last thing on your mind. Like, so people are so busy right now. Sometimes it's just that your body's changed and what you like's changed and you haven't really taken the time to explore that. And sometimes it is really just like a hormonal issue. Usually not. Usually it's like a multiple issue. So yes, testosterone is one of the things, but I have a great sex therapist. It's on my podcast. It's local that I have people work with. I really like the Rosie app. I don't know if you're familiar with that. This is a great place to refer your patients. So it's an app. It was developed by an OBGYN, Dr. Harper. You should have her on. She's out of Texas. And, you know, she was having trouble with the sexual issues that her patients were coming to. And she created this app where they have everything from like erotica at like different levels of steaminess that people can handle to sex coaches and like anonymous group therapy. And they have like all of these different levels of ways that you can kind of address libido and information. So I'd like to refer people to the Rosie app. There are some supplements out there with some limited evidence. Typically, I don't know if we can talk about different particular brands, but I like the Hello Bonafide brand for a lot of their supplements because they have things like Reverie, which is hyaluronic acid for the vagina. They have some supplements for menopause, and they have one called Restella for libido, which, you know, for some people it doesn't work. And for some people, they tell me it's life-changing. So it's a little bit like of a, you know, see what works for them. And then there are the kind of newer non-hormonal things that are out there. So there's Addy, which is the sort of oral medication that, you know, people will call like the female Viagra. It's not female Viagra, but it is something that can improve interest and can improve sort of the sexual experience in general. Just like anything else, it's not perfect for everybody. I've had some patients who haven't gotten much improvement from it, some that do. The data I find is not super compelling. Like, you know, one increased sex episode a month, but I think it's also a little bit of how they have to measure that. So, you know, it's really hard to measure your interest in sex or your sexual satisfaction. So just one episode a month sure might be like a big deal for somebody who wasn't having sex before or wasn't having enjoyable sex before. And then there's bremelide, which is more the injection. I don't use as much of that because I find not many people want to inject themselves an hour before sex. So I don't tend to use a lot of that. But the point is that there are options out there. There are things that you can do. You can at least, you know, refer people to some podcasts or some literature or to the Rosie app so they can start kind of thinking about, okay, what is the issue that I'm really having? Everybody, of course, wants to just pop a pill and like have everything all be better. But that's really not the solution for most people. It's usually kind of communication in their relationship and working on the pain issues and a very sort of multifaceted approach.
Yeah, I mean, I was taught, and I tell this to my patients, you know, the brain is the biggest sex organ, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, if you don't like the person you're with, like, tough to be intimate with them, or dealing with significant financial distress and you're going to lose your house or get fired from your job, like, yeah, it makes sense that your brain is, like, busy doing other stuff. So, like,
hard to feel often, sexy at that time.
it makes it tougher for everybody involved. And so to be able to elicit that history and understand what this, you know, the stress that people are going through, back to what we were talking about earlier, like, it's to say, you know, it sounds like you're dealing with a lot. Sounds like maybe your brain is prioritizing things here, and, like, don't put that much pressure on yourself to be everything. And sometimes just hearing that, listening to your patients and providing reassurance that, like, they're not broken, they're super busy. And then most of the time, that's where the conversation goes, and they just needed to hear it. And sometimes they'll bring their partners back in. They, you know, say, listen, things are stressful right now. Things are crazy right now. And, like, let's just make sure we're putting things in order. And so I think that's a huge part of it, but to know that there are other options. And sometimes, and I do get to the point where patients are like, no, everything's great. And I'm still just, you know, my libido is not where I want it to be. And so to know that there are other options, there are things out there that may work, is pretty valuable for patients. It's pretty powerful knowing that at least there's things out there they can try, and whether it's apps. And this seems to be a topic so ripe for social media, you know, blogs or groups and things like that online, because people like me don't know enough. And so they're going wherever they can to get help. So having someone like you, who's an authority in this, who's trained, who's done their homework, who can provide that information, I think I'm not surprised at all that you've got a lot of people very interested in your show and in what you're doing.
I think that we really underestimate, and this may sound a little bit like woo-woo, but I think that we really underestimate as doctors, like, how much we really are healers, and how much sometimes just listening to our patients, validating their concerns, giving them options, letting them know that, okay, maybe this isn't the answer, but I'm going to stick with you and we're going to keep working on this until we get you feeling better. Like, that has tremendous healing effects. There's data to show that even just understanding what's going on with your body in menopause and in many other conditions makes a huge difference. And having somebody who's a caregiver, who's has some knowledge and information, and who can share that with you and who cares about what's going on with you, it makes such a difference. And I think we really underestimate that. There is so much out there in social media in terms of misinformation. And that's really part of why I wanted to get out there and at least, you know, put out some good information. It's not like some magical cure. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, you're going to evade menopause with these three easy steps. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do. It's really basic information that people just need to hear, and they need to, you know, trust it enough that they're going to act on it. And that's really the difference.
I think maybe it's our pelvic pain training too. I think a lot of it is, we've heard so many people over the years who just say, no one believed that I was in pain. Like, just saying, no, I believe you. I can't promise results. I can't promise an outcome, but I can promise that I'll be here, that I'll keep seeing you, that we'll try to figure out what's going on. And oftentimes, like, it's not all they want. They want to feel better, but at the very basic level, like, I believe you. And what's the line at the beginning of your show? You're not alone. You're not crazy. Is that what? Yeah. So
the reverse, like, but yes, you're not crazy and you're not alone.
I mean, they could be crazy and alone, but that's not always the reason. But right, I think just like we said, validating and just listening. And it's whatever we're doing in medicine, maybe in life, just listening to people and not trying to solve it necessarily. It's not always about the solution. Sometimes it's just about having someone who's willing to walk down that road with them and just say, "I'll be there for you, and you can keep coming back to see me, and we'll listen." And that seems to be a very powerful thing that many of our patients in both chronic pelvic pain and other complex medical conditions where we don't always have the answer. And this is a big one. This is one that is extremely common that affects, like we said, almost
everybody
if you live long enough, right?
I agree 100%. I do think that my pelvic pain training really helped me to get into this area more, because just like you said, I mean, my pelvic pain visits probably take the longest, but I would say the menopause visits are like the second longest there, because once you start listening, people really open up and they have all of these things that like they just never really shared because nobody really gave them the time of day to do that before. And so that's where it is helpful to have a resource to kind of get them started and move through. But so many times it's just really, you know, they went to multiple different doctors, just like those pelvic pain patients, and they were told, no, you're too young to be in menopause because you're 42 and not 52, or, you know, you're still having your period, or your FSH is low today, so it can't be that. And so, again, like, you've got to put the pieces together and validate them and walk with them.
So what's next on the horizon for medicine or for menopause? What's coming down the, is it pike or pipe?
Coming down the pipeline. There are a few things that are sort of new-ish in the menopause area too. It's not all just estrogen therapy. Earlier, well, I guess it was last year now, there was the release of Veozah, which is the neurokinin 3 receptor antagonist. That's for hot flushes specifically. I do think that that's a nice option that's out there for people who can't or don't want to be on hormones, and particularly people who are kind of like aging out of when the hormones are really safe. So that's something that's new. There are some newer vaginal suppositories, so like a DHEA suppository. It's been around for a little while, but for people who've been out of training, you may not have really looked into that. So for people who aren't tolerating estrogens or who have issues, that's an option down there too. There's combinations of estradiol with selective estrogen receptor modulators for hormone replacement therapy for people who aren't tolerating the progesterone side of therapy. So we have a lot of sort of new-ish stuff. So people who have been out of their training for, you know, 5 to 10 years or more, like we have, you have to kind of keep up on some of that. In terms of what the future looks like, I mean, hopefully better research. I do think that menopause is kind of having a moment in society and women's health. The, you know, lack of research in women's health is being a little bit more recognized and a little more federal funding starting to go towards that. So hopefully we'll get a little bit more information along the way. But I really think that what I see for the future of menopause care is really a more comprehensive care solution. So not just a, like, you come in for 10 minutes, we measure your hormones and give you like a pellet, but really what we've been talking about this whole time, having a conversation, using medications when we need to, but also using lifestyle factors. You know, there's lots of data out there supporting things like diet and exercise and meditation and acupuncture and all of these other things that can help along with the symptoms. So I think really bringing those together in a more comprehensive way is important. And just making sure that both providers like ourselves and then people are understand what's coming and understand that menopause is a part of life and that it can start, you know, earlier than, you know, people think about it as like grandmas, and it can start a lot earlier than that. And just recognizing that and getting people to treatment and to getting to understanding a little bit easier, I think is so important. And also kind of recognizing that this is like a new phase of life. It's not the end of things. I mean, people kind of think of it as like sometimes the end of womanhood or the end of my sex life or the end of, it's not that. And so many people that I have spoken to through the podcast and now more and more with my patients, it really can be a new beginning, a time to make, you know, pivots in your life to kind of reevaluate where you want to be. I have so many patients that are postmenopausal who tell me their sex life is better than it's ever been because they've gotten rid of all of their kind of preconceived notions of what sex should be like and are actually like doing it for themselves for the first time in their lives. So it really can be a great time. We just need to give people that sort of comprehensive care that they need and hopefully get a lot more data on the treatments that we're giving and the safety and how long we can use them, what doses we should use, and all of this information.
So much to learn, and we should, you know, we can have you back on in a year or so and you can tell us all the things that have come out in that time and review everything. Well, I know you're busy. We appreciate you coming on. This has been extremely helpful for me and hopefully some of our listeners who, like me, have not been as up to date for our patients as they should be, or at least aren't aware of what's going on, aren't as aware of what's going on out there for managing and caring for folks with menopause. So thank you so much for coming on. And we encourage all of our listeners to listen to Enrich Menopause, wherever you get your podcasts. And also, I'm going to start using it as a resource for my patients. So let them know so they can go get their questions answered by somebody who actually has an answer, who actually knows something. So thank you so much. It was a pleasure catching up, and I look forward to catching up with you soon. So thank you very much, Dr. Jessica Rich.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to follow the podcast, rate it 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at _backtableobgyn on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable OBGYN is hosted by myself, Mark Hoffman,
and Amy Park.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor Spurgeon Hess and Yvonne Obrzynski.
Show notes and social media by Emma Landenwich and Lindsay Beecham.
Administrative support provided by Jim Roy Kennebrew.
Music written and performed by Scott Baby Daddy Hoffman.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on Backtable OBGYN are their own and do not reflect the views or positions of their employers or any entities they represent.